through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Okay, before we get started today, just a quick addendum to the update that you just heard there. Some of these conferences are still meeting and trying to figure out what's going on, whether to play college football this season. We just got news that the Big Ten has canceled their football season. They will consider playing in the spring. So we'll keep you updated as to what's going on with the Pac-12 as news breaks. An announcement is expected today or tomorrow, according to some sources. So whenever that news breaks about the Pac-12 and what their intentions are, we will have it for you. Meanwhile, in Arlington, Texas last night, the Rangers decided to have a little experiment while the Mariners were in town. Apparently, the Rangers can't score any runs right now. They can't hit any home runs, which is really unusual for them because in the old ballparks, plural, they could hit home runs in bunches. No problem. That desert air, 103-degree weather, whatever it is, boom, home runs left and right. Well, not the case at the new ballpark. And one of the theories was it's because the roof has been closed. The roof has been closed, and that's basically why they built the new ballpark, right? To keep maybe cooler temperatures. It's too hot outside. Let's get a roof. Let's enclose the whole building. So we'll see how that goes. Well, that hasn't gone all that well for the Rangers. So what did they decide to do last night? They decided to open the thing up. Open roof, Mariners in town. They actually asked the Mariners permission. Service was like, yeah, do whatever you want. Well, I'll tell you what it did not lead to. It did not lead to a bunch of Ranger home runs. But it did lead to this, cut two.
The 0-1 pitch to Lewis on the way. Breaking ball, swing, and a fly ball deep into left center field. Going back on the run is Solak to the wall, reaches up, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. Kyle Lewis with his fourth home run of the season. Holy smokes, drives in three. And the Mariners now have the lead 4-2 over the Texas Rangers. RBIs number 11, 12, and 13 on the year for the kid from Snellville, Georgia. What a start for Lewis.
Yeah, good start for Lewis. Also, how about Kyle Seager doing what he always does in Arlington, regardless of the ballpark? Cut three.
The 0-1. Swinging a high fly ball, carrying out to right field. Gallo is back, leaping, gone, grand slam, Kyle Seager. The fifth of his career, and Kyle Seager brings them all home. He has blown this game open in the sixth inning. It's 9-2 Mariners.
Dylan Moore added one of his own to make it 10-2, and guys, the Mariners come up with a big, big win. First of all, before we get to how this season is feeling and how each win is feeling right now, what do you think of these shenanigans by the Rangers, Stacy?
You know, it was a try, and sometimes we all have to shoot our shot, you know, figuratively speaking, and I respect it. I respect them saying, hey, let's try something new. And it did work out. There were hits, you know what I mean? There were a lot of hits. There were a lot of runs. So it wasn't by them. You know, it wasn't by the Rangers, but that's fun. That's fun baseball.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of backfired on you just a little bit, and I love that the Mariners and Scott Service and the organization was saying, sure, yeah, open that thing up. And you have Kyle Seager, who is just the absolute Rangers killer down there in Arlington, hits a grand slam, Kyle Lewis doing his thing, and you love to see Dylan Moore, who actually really struggled last season at the plate, who's hitting pretty well right now. And gosh, it was just so fun to watch these guys. And you love just a little extra, you know, division rivalry, them trying to figure something out, them trying to try something new to help them beat the Mariners, and the Mariners kind of shoved it right back to them. Love moments like that.
Yeah, Justin Dunn got a little bit of trouble there early, but then basically hung in there, shut him down. I mean, everything the last couple of games, the last two games, has worked. And now, you know, in baseball, to talk about two games is like talking about nothing. Two games in football is like talking about everything. NHL, NBA, it's kind of in between. But I got this feeling last night, like every win this year feels different than it has in the past. And I don't know if it's because it's just a 60-game season and everything is kind of compressed, or if it's because baseball is just back and I'm real happy about that, or if it's because I'm seeing the future. Like, watching this team with the young players doing what they're doing and showing promise, I feel like it could be like looking into a crystal ball and seeing what's going to happen into the future. Which one of those three, first of all, if you agree with me that this year's wins feel more exciting individually, which one of those three do you think it is? What do you think, Jake?
To me, I look at these young players being key contributors to these wins. Now, 60 games, I think, is easier to digest if this team is struggling. I believe that is very true. And so you want to capitalize. You're willing to go through the bad losses because you know you have to enjoy it while it lasts, because we only have this for 2 months, Mariners baseball right now. But I look at Kyle Lewis. I look at J.P. Crawford and his bat getting going and his defense. And you look at Evan White getting a base hit after he's been struggling, but he's been so great with his glove. You just look at different points of the potential superstars of this team of the future. They are the ones that are contributing to the wins of this team. And that's why, to me, it feels so exciting. It's not just, okay, hey, you've got guys that are still struggling, they're trying to make their way, and we're seeing them develop. No, they're coming through for the team in big ways, in big moments. That, to me, is why it's so fun and exciting.
Yeah, I agree. It is exciting. To me, and I'm kind of echoing what Jake said, but I had the same thought. The bad stuff is stuff you thought would be bad. The bullpen, right? No one was expecting it to be full of fantastic performances. Pitching to start the season, we knew that that would struggle, not just for the Mariners, but for every team, because pitchers were probably hardest hit by the delay to the season. And then the good stuff, though, is even better than you thought it would be. Evan White is even better on defense than I thought he would be. We knew that he would struggle at the plate. We talked to Rick Riz about this. We talked to Goldie about this. I think Mike Blowers might have mentioned this too, that that's probably an area where he would need to improve, and it would be kind of a dose of reality for him going up against big leaguers, and it didn't help starting the season going up against Justin Verlander, of all people. But his defense is better than I thought it would be. Likewise, Kyle Lewis, I was hoping, like, yeah, I mean, maybe he keeps it going. You know, I'd love to see him, start the season with some encouraging development from continuing from last year. Yeah, he's been, like, their best player. So I think that that's the best news if you're a Mariners fan, that the stuff you were hoping would be good is even better than you thought it would be.
Yeah, Lewis, by the way, admitted that the playing time that he got at the end of the season last year definitely helped him come into this year and essentially pick up where he left off. I mean, I guess every single time, what are you raising your hand for at me? What's up with you?
Kel Nick. I want to see it just for that same reason. I know people laugh at it and scoff at it. Shannon Dreyer, I brought it up just before the season one last time, and she just laughed me pretty much
good
off of the question.
I'm glad.
Which I do too, because it was, you know, gearing ourselves and getting ourselves actually focused. But for those reasons, that's why I would love to see Jared Kelnick at the end of the year if he's playing well and doing well down there, just because I do believe that Kyle Lewis got an incredible amount of confidence at the end of last year, which is leading to him playing the way he's playing now.
It's a good point.
Oh, okay. So you're
saying, at first I thought you were saying put Kelnick in now, and I was like, Jake, stop.
Right. Right.
But
so
that is
you're
a good
saying
point.
If you bring up Kelnick at some point, that it could benefit him the same way it did Lewis. Yeah, I can dig that.
Can you dig it?
I mean,
I can dig it.
He can dig it. Now, the other person that I'm really excited about is seeing Sheffield, seeing Justin Dunn. And we have talked about this, and this is one of the other things that you look at with the Mariners is how can they develop a winning culture and a winning attitude and a mindset when they're losing? And when you see J.P. Crawford, Kyle Lewis, you see Evan White, although he's struggling at the plate a little bit, he's been unbelievable defensively. Austin Nola, Dylan Moore, and then you see Sheffield and Marco and these guys putting things together. You're building a winning mentality by the performances that they're putting together, the confidence that they're gaining together, which is really exciting. And that to me is the part that I look forward to. I'm not saying that they're going to be playoff ready next year, but certainly it looks like they're heading in the right direction with the key pieces they need.
Yeah, 7-11 is 7-11. It's nothing to write home about. But if they go at that pace all the way, so what? The point, I guess, in us bringing this up and what occurred to me last night is every time they win a game, it's because the guys who are part of the plan are showing development within that game. Sheffield the other day, Dunn last night. Lewis continuing doing what he's doing. Seager's going to be part of this team for the next couple of years, so he might as well play well, too, and he is right now. I mean, Nola behind the plate, he's not even supposed to be their catcher, right? And he's doing a pretty decent job, and he can hit as well. So, I mean, you've got Dylan Moore is a really nice surprise. He's supposed to be a bench player, like, if that. I mean, he's been a tremendous – he's been really – he might be their second-best player, really, or offensive player – next to Kyle Lewis so far this year when he's actually in the lineup. So when they win games, there's a purpose to it. And because it's a 60-game season, it's easier to see that. If we were playing 162 right now and we were only 18 games into April, it would be more difficult to see that because we'd keep saying, well, you got to wait till 50 games to see what they really are, and it's a long season, it's this, it's that. No, right now, they're using the limited amount of time that they have to go out there and develop and get this plan going. And right now, it's working. It is. Anybody want to add anything before we jump to three questions here?
No, let's roll.
Yeah, let's roll.
One quick question.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
All right, so the reason that they built this new park in Texas, Globe Life Park, is because they didn't have a roof on the other stadium. A roof. And they wanted it to be a little cooler in there because, you know, it's hot. Guys are getting hot out there, man. Long summer. So if they figured out that opening up the roof benefited the Rangers last night and they ended up leaving it open for any game, for every game, what was the purpose of building the ballpark in the first place, people? Jake?
Great question, because they spent how much money? $1 billion on the stadium, making it new. And upgrading. I mean, their ballpark previously was not much older than T-Mobile Park is. I mean, a pretty new baseball stadium, and yet they've already moved on. I mean, that's crazy. So at this point, you got to look at it and say, look, the Rangers are desperate if they're looking to opening up the roof to hope that their bats get hot. That's, I think, a low point.
Wait, are you saying why did they elect to build it at all if the roof isn't necessary?
Yeah, because that was one of the big arguments to build a new stadium. We need a roof. We need to enclose the place.
I mean, I don't mind having a roof when it's raining, however often it rains there. Who knows? But
yeah, never.
You never know, though. There could be a day when it looks great. You go there, it rains, and you're thinking, well, this is the worst. For that matter, I'd like to contend that people who say that real Seattleites don't have umbrellas are wrong. Because if you have hair that gets curly, it's a bummer. So
I think the biggest reason they wanted a roof is that they could air condition the place, because it gets to be 105, 106 degrees out in Arlington.
True. Get some shade. Also, like, this is sports. You're always trying to have the coolest, best stadium ever.
Stacey, to me, this is... Hold on a second. Hold on, Jake. Wait one second here. How come when Curtis says that, you say true and you agree, but when I say it, you, like I did 10 seconds ago, you debate the point?
I didn't debate the point. What I did was I went off the rails, and instead I said that people who say that that real Seattleites don't need umbrellas are liars.
Can we boil this all down to one simple thought? That athletes and teams are superstitious. That
oh,
if
yes,
things aren't working,
1,000%.
They're going to try something else and go, maybe this is the magical sauce that we're going to need to get our bats going. Okay, my routine was off. Maybe I need to do this, and that's what's going to help me. And then they never change it once it works.
Athletes.
So I think for the Rangers' sake, for Tom's point, if the bats worked and the roof was the reason that they determined the bats were cold, and now they're going to leave it down the entire time, there's zero point of building it in the first place.
206 None. Says,
having
been in the old stadium, the seats would burn your skin, so the roof was there to help fans as well as players.
I believe it, but if they're going to leave it open all the time, then what's the...
There's so many fans there right now.
Huh?
There's so many fans
well,
there
we
right
didn't
now.
Know this would be happening, Curtis. Yeah,
I know. It was low-hanging fruit.
It's just like they spend $1 billion over a roof. Meanwhile, in our city, it took 8 years to refurbish a building that we already had. Next.
Number two.
My buddy Jason Smith over at Fox Sports Radio, he hosts the night shift over there. He's also a Jet fan, and he was tweeting his distrust of Jamal Adams at me last night. So what's more likely about Jamal Adams, guys? That he's a ticking time bomb with a destructive personality, or he just hated playing for the Jets? Jake.
B. If I'm an all-pro player that has high aspirations, I'm going to hate playing for a dysfunctional franchise that I don't believe is going to get their act together. If this was a dysfunctional franchise that you had a head coach and a GM that you believed in, and you saw your team progressing and moving forward, I think Jamal Adams would still be a New York Jet. But he's seeing this team. He's seeing a dysfunctional head coach. I'm not sure how Adam Gase got another opportunity to be a head coach so soon. It's not like what he did in Miami makes you believe that he could be successful again as a head coach. And then we're still trying to figure out who Douglas is as a GM in this league. And obviously communications were not exactly what Jamal Adams wanted them to be. Now, was Jamal, looking for more than what he deserves or looking for too much? I don't know. But overall, if you don't have trust in your organization, then it's going to be great. As a player, I want out too.
Maybe this is wishful thinking, but I think he just hated playing for the Jets. It's a poorly run organization, and if you're their best player, especially on defense or in a position where careers can sometimes be shorter just because you're putting your body on the line all the time, I think that you're very aware of a window, and it would be very frustrating to feel like you care more about that window than your team does. I think we haven't heard fantastic things about Adam Gase. I think it would be more of a red flag if it was an organization that I thought was in any way similar to Seattle, and I don't see that with the Jets. So I'm going with it's the Jets rather than a toxic personality.
Yeah, the player can be as fiery as he wants to be as long as he doesn't tear a locker room apart a la Terrell Owens. I mean, I think I've heard Jets players say that they really like him. They hate to lose him because he's a really good player. But I didn't hear anything about him being destructive within the locker room. So if that's the case, I'm thinking it's just because he was wary of the way Adam Gase ran things and didn't trust that him or that organization to be able to win. We'll see what happens
and
here.
Why would you?
Loses, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah, right.
What evidence have they given you? I mean, I don't think Jamal Adams comes here and is anywhere near that person, that player. I think this is a perfect fit for this organization. He provides exactly what you're looking for, both on and off the field. And if I'm John Schneider and Pete Carroll, I couldn't be more fired up that the Prez is in Seattle.
Three.
Number three.
baseball is considering the bubble idea for the playoffs. Why? Well, they think that, A, you're looking at the NBA and the NHL right now, and they're doing just fine, getting away free. But when it comes to the playoffs, you don't want to have happen what's already happened with the Miami Marlins and the St. Louis Cardinals. If we're in the middle of a World Series or a playoff series, and all of a sudden guys are getting sick and they can't play for a week, that's going to really throw a wrench into the playoff schedule. Can't do that. So what do you think about the bubble idea, Stacey?
I think it's smart, and I think it's important that Passan likened what the MLB bubble would look like more with what the NHL is doing, and even slightly more expanded than that, saying, hey, this isn't going to be the NBA where you're all in one location, just because that might not be feasible for as many teams are going to be competing, and with the parks that you need, you can't quite do it the same way. You need more space. So he suggested having like three hubs for a wild card round and then narrowing that down to two hubs for a division series, which I think is very doable with the MLB.
For Major League Baseball to consider this, I think is positive, because it would be awful to go through the playoffs and have an outbreak happen on one of your playoff teams, not be able to participate, and therefore essentially forfeit a game or two, because you can't stop the playoffs. You can't stop and postpone it even longer just so these teams can get their games in. It has to go through smoothly. They're on a time schedule, on a time crunch with these TV deals that they have, and if they're going to make sure and do everything that they can to go through it without any problems, then yeah, I do believe that they need to go into a bubble like the NHL, like the NBA, and it would be more feasible to do that because you're dealing with less teams, obviously.
It seems like the right idea. I mean, hockey's got a couple of, what do they call them, hot spots? I don't know what they're called. Like each one of the venues that they're using. Hubs. Okay. Hot spots. Hubs.
You don't want to use hot spots. The opposite of a hot spot. A hub.
Oh, yeah, right. The opposite. You're right. Hot spot is not what we want. We want the exact opposite of that. All right. Well, yeah, I think it's a good thing to consider. I'm not sure what the drawback would be other than the isolation, maybe from your family for a month if you're the two teams that end up making it all the way through. We'll see. But, yeah, I think it's probably a pretty good idea. All right, we'll ask Mike Salk what he thinks of that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
Great to have Mike Salk in with us. By the way, you can check out the Brock and Salk podcast at brockandsalkpodcast.com. I believe, Mike, that drops at 6 tonight. Is that
drops true? Tonight, Tommy. You're absolutely right. New podcast. Bruce Feldman talking about kind of where this whole thing is going in college sports. Brock and I have our big storylines, what to watch for heading into Seahawks training camp this week, and then an old school batch of Answer the Question Jerk questions as well.
What was the best? Can you tease a little bit?
Yeah, Brock had one great storyline. I don't know whether you guys are prepared to watch for this or not yet, but he's curious to see if Russell Wilson can have a good year. I was like, dude, that doesn't count.
Are we going to finally see a franchise quarterback?
Well, if Russell doesn't have a great year, they're not going to be good. Like, yeah, no duh. Like, that doesn't count as a major storyline to watch for.
Major storyline. Will Russell Wilson be healthy?
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, one I liked from Brock, and I'll kind of tease a little to it, is just, are the Seahawks going to get that swagger back that they've had? And they've spent so much time and energy trying to get back to the level of swagger they had before. That, you know, throw Jamal Adams back into the mix, and I think there's a real conversation now about whether or not they can achieve that. I mean, it's a very Brock kind of storyline, clearly, which, you know, is worth making fun of, but it's also there's some reality in there that they haven't been the bullies on the block for the last couple of years since Cam retired, and if they're able to change some of that and Jamal Adams brings some of that back to the table, I think that's probably a huge positive for them.
It is a huge positive. I was smiling the entire time as you were saying that, just because I can't help but when people talk about swagger, did they get their swagger back? Just that cut.
Oh, we played it. Don't worry.
I'm sure you did. And, yeah, that's right. It's one of my all-time favorite cuts. but, Salk, we had an interesting conversation at the top of the show where, you know, Tom and all of us are watching these Mariners games, and particularly the wins, and just enjoying every second of it. And we're trying, and we explored kind of why that was, what was the reason behind that, and why do you think it is so much fun watching this team, especially, obviously, it's fun to watch your team win, but why is it seem like it's more fun or more enjoyable than years past?
One thing that's helped me is that I can turn off the losses. Like, when they get down like they did the other day, like, oh, this one got away from them. See ya. And, like, I don't care that much. Like, okay, that game isn't going to – they're not like – it's not like everyone counts because they're desperately trying to make the playoffs or win the division or whatever it is. So when the bullpen comes in and just has a bad day, which with this bullpen is going to happen, I just kind of walk away. Like, okay, cool. I'll go do something else. And then it allows me to essentially limit the amount of time I'm watching the Mariners to just the good times. I'm watching early in the game. I'm seeing Dunn pitch well yesterday. I thought Sheffield looked great two nights ago. Kikuchi actually looked better for a little while until eventually things kind of fell apart on him like they've done. But, you know, that it means that for the most part, if you're watching the games the way I am, you're only seeing the positive. We're seeing Kyle Lewis. We're seeing Kyle Seager. We're seeing Austin Nola. And you're seeing what Dylan Moore has done the last couple days, or what Lopes has done throughout this season. You're seeing, for the most part, real positives that you can draw from. And the negatives you get to just kind of ignore, which is a nice, fun way to watch a team.
I want to transition quickly to college football, just since we keep getting lots of developments, but maybe no big answers yet. It seems like a lot is still up in the air. There's obviously the news of the Big Ten postponing its fall football season this morning. It looks like now we're seeing that the Pac-12 is going to have a Zoom call or Zoom press conference at 1:30 p.m. That'll be during our show, so we'll keep you guys updated on what goes on with that. But what's going to happen if some conferences cancel and some don't?
First of all, I'm really surprised the Pac-12 can even use Zoom. They don't use like some off.
First of all,
some
the interns
off
are absolutely doing this
right.
for them. Like, this is not
something big in China.
Yeah, Larry Scott's like, well, Zoom. Too many people are using that.
We're actually going to send out glasses. People put on, and then we'll give you the screen on the glasses.
We have this glass. Kirkland brand version of Zoom that we think will work just as well for half
Kirkland,
of the people.
Kirkland brand is great.
What a ridiculous conference. But look, the Big Ten is as big a domino as you could get other than the SEC. I mean, they are the one and two in the importance of the conferences and the passion of their fans. So, you know, it sounds like the ACC is looking for a way to hang on. The SEC is going to hang on, even if they have to be the only people playing college sports this year. But I think the Big Ten is a pretty good indicator of the Pac-12. I mean, know that they're not exactly the same, but the Big Ten has some real universities there that actually care about academics. I think it's probably more similar to the Pac-12 than either the ACC, although the ACC has Duke and UNC, Wake Forest, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But more so certainly than the SEC is. So I think that's a pretty good indicator. I can't imagine the Pac-12 is going to play games.
I can't either, but what does it look like if the SEC does?
It looks like one grouping of fans have nothing else. I mean, that's all they've got. The Pac-12, the fans don't care enough to push them over the top. The SEC is on top. They bring in a tremendous amount of money through their network, through everything else they do, because their fans are rabid. They're insane.
But then don't you want to know what caused one conference to cancel and another to keep going? Because one of them is either overreacting or one of them isn't listening enough.
Well, fine. But look where those conferences are and who are the people associated. I mean, I think a lot of it is the political reality of the way the West Coast looks at things. And then look at some of the, you know, Michigan and parts of Wisconsin and Minnesota, and a lot of the places in the Big Ten are going to be on the left. And for the most part, the SEC schools are going to be in states that are on the right. And they're both sides of the political spectrum are handling this pandemic and everything associated with the science around it completely differently. So this doesn't surprise. It's exactly as the country seems to be handling these things. And sports can be a perfect lens into the way our country is handling every issue right now. So none of that surprises me. The other part of it, though, is just how much more important this stuff is to folks in SEC country. This is their life. They don't have pro sports. B, they don't have much else in general. This is it. Whereas in Pac-12 and even a lot of the Big Ten cities, it's like, well, okay, in Detroit, maybe you don't have Michigan football, but you've got the Red Wings and you've got the Pistons and, you know, you got the Tigers and you got the Lions. Like, you got four other major sports there. In Los Angeles, you got a million other things. San Francisco, you got a million other things. In Montgomery, Alabama, that's the ball game.
Yeah.
And so the difference in the way these things are handled, I think, is enormous.
Yeah, I do agree with a lot of what you just said. You know, Salk, one of the questions that I had for you in regards to this is, I love the idea of postponing to the spring. What do you think that's even a real function for college football right now, that they can postpone to the spring and play and then expect to turn it right back around to the fall? Are we just delaying the inevitable?
Probably. But yeah, and that's sort of the way these things are. I was thinking just the other day when it looks now like our kids' school is not going to get going, of course, and it's still going to be online once we get back to September. And I was thinking about how when this thing first shut down, I was like, okay, it's going to be a couple weeks without school. And then we heard the superintendent come on and make some reference like, well, it might not be for the rest of the year. We were like, what?
Wait, they said that maybe the entire upcoming school year?
No, well, no. This was last year. They said, okay, the rest of last. This was like, okay, well, 2.5 months. Like, there's no way that could be true. And then we started hearing rumblings of like, well, maybe it's even going to be into next year. And we laughed. We're like, no, surely by next school year, this will be figured out. So, yeah, they can say spring, but I don't believe anything anymore. I mean, like, once you start delaying things, they can just go on indefinitely. I'll be shocked if the Big Ten plays spring football.
Yeah, it's impossible to predict anything more than like a week or two out, it seems.
No kidding.
But speaking of that, though, what do you think about the idea of baseball doing the playoffs in a bubble? Good idea?
Yeah, how do you do it? So is there going to be what? There's 16 teams at that point, right? Why do you need to do it in a bubble? Like, if it's worked until then, why do you have to be in a bubble? Just so you don't have to cancel part of, like, a team
that's... Because the stakes are higher.
Right. So if the Cardinals situation were to happen again, right, but they were in the playoffs, all of a sudden now they get eliminated instead of just missing games. Yeah, that makes sense. Sure. I'm up for that. I mean, there's no fans in the crowd anyway, so what's the difference? I mean, I guess there's a little difference in, like, okay, I built my team for my ballpark or something like that, but... Yeah. If your team's not good enough to win wherever you are, then you probably don't deserve to win the World Series. So, yeah, I'm into that, depending, obviously, on how they pull it off. Anybody think Rob Manfred's got the ability to do that?
Why not?
Just sort of based on how he's handled just about everything else. I just don't know whether he's got enough juice, creativity, et cetera, right now to do all of that. But
I mean, I think it sounds like the people around him.
He just suspended an Astro for 20 games. Did anybody notice that?
He suspended an Astros coach for 20 games.
So, it's somebody.
Didn't Alex Cintron, wasn't he part of the Diamondbacks organization when they went to the World Series?
Yeah, he was like a pinch hitter.
Yeah.
He's like Tony Womack, right? Aren't they like kind of the same?
Pretty much.
That's what I think.
Jay Bell. All those
when Tony Womack had that big hit, was it Cintron that came around to score on it? Or am I thinking, I don't know. I have them connected in my mind, along with Craig Counsell.
I think Quentin McCracken, Junior Spivey, Tony Womack, and Alex Cintron are the same.
Yes, Junior Spivey's definitely the same as Alex Cintron and Tony Womack. The difference, though, is that Quentin McCracken, I think, was like the first pick of one of the expansion teams. Was it the Devil Rays?
Yeah.
I know he was that one of the expansion teams around then was building their whole team around him. Didn't work. As it turns out, he wasn't very good.
It was a long play. Right,
it was they were playing the long game on that. All right, guys.
See ya. Take care, Mikey. All right, coming up next, it's going to be the second edition of Stacy's off-season questions. This one concerns our wide receiver situation. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hey, Stacy, did you notice that when I teased to break, like, what we were going to do this segment, I said Stacy's got her next off-season question as it relates to our wide receiver situation. Like, I consider myself a member of this team at this point.
Like, I think the team does too, Tom.
I mean, not only am I a 12, but, like, I'm essentially on the team. I'm more connected to him even than Jake.
Yeah.
But wait. What about the Giants, though, Tom? Because
who?
Like, are you playing both sides here? Or
oh, yeah, you can't play for
your,
both teams.
Is this your commitment and your divorce from the Giants, and now you're committing to the Seahawks outright? Like, what? I just want to clarify this.
Well, I can't tell the public that I'm a double agent. Oops, I just did.
Got it.
Sorry.
It could be that the Seahawks wide receiver battle's a little open after DK Metcalf, so maybe you feel like you have a better chance to make this roster.
Yeah, like I can actually be on the team.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? Other than Sterling Shepard, I'm not even sure I could name a Giant receiver. And I'm not even sure if he's on the team anymore. He might not be. Anyway, let's get to the Seahawks here.
Okay.
Wide receiver number three is the question of the day. Is it even worth it, Stacey, to designate one player as the third wide receiver in this offense? Or is it 1-2 and then everybody?
You know, so what I wrote is that right now the Seahawks offense does effectively look like Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, who had 900 yards, and then everyone else. And that's not weird. If you look at the receiving yards organized by most to least for pretty much any team in the league, you're going to see one or two guys with the bulk of the yards and then kind of everyone else. Or you're going to see maybe three or four guys with, say, you know, between 400 and 900 yards and then everyone else, depending on whether or not a team spreads the ball around. I think, though, that the Seahawks would probably like to see one or two other reliable targets emerge for Russell Wilson. Because what happens when you have too much of those yards concentrated at the top is that unless you've got a receiver that can just dominate any cornerback, any safety, anyone, you end up getting guys in double coverage all the time, right? Tyler Lockett still performed really well in double coverage. Now you've got DK Metcalf, so that helps a little bit. But I can guarantee you that this team wants to see someone else emerge as that third receiver. So I had a game for you guys. It's very quick. It's a single question. Jake will have to lie about his answer since he already spoiled it. Who would you guess, and people, you listeners can answer on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line 710-710. If you have to think of it off the top of your head, who was the Seahawks' third leading receiver?
Are we talking pass catcher or just receiver?
Receiving yards. Pass catcher. Give
okay,
me anyone.
So it could be a tight end then.
It can be anyone. It's just in receiving yards.
All right. So the candidates are going to be like David Moore, Hollister. Was Jerron Brown on the team last year?
Yes.
Yes.
He was.
Yes,
okay,
he was.
So
yes.
That's three. I'm going to go with Hollister.
It was Jacob Hollister. It was. Yeah. And here's the thing. If you were listening and you did not guess it, that's okay. And that isn't a slight on Jacob Hollister because he still finished with almost 350 yards and three touchdowns when he didn't even make the initial 53-man roster to start the season. So he had a good year for what you brought in to be a backup tight end. And we all know that he was really promising. The Seahawks placed a tender on him as a restricted free agent to bring him back. So he's still part of the mix. But my bet is that one of three guys will look to compete for that role. Philip Dorsett, I think that he has maybe the highest ceiling of the receivers they brought in. He's also someone they brought in as an outside free agent. Greg Olsen or Will Dissly. The challenge for Will Dissly will be to stay healthy. And for Greg Olsen, I expect him to be incorporated very early into this passing game. And then the third one, I combined the two tight ends, might be David Moore. And I know that you're doubting that, and that might be the least likely, but he's one of the veteran most receivers at this point. So I'm curious to see if he's going to make a push to move up that depth chart.
Can I tell you who should be and who Seahawks fans
you sure can
should be receiver
yeah,
three?
Yeah, there's one I didn't say.
In terms of targets and receiving yards, to me, it's Greg Olsen. Greg Olsen is the guy that you want to be the third leading receiver on this team in touchdowns, catches, and receiving yards. If Greg Olsen is operating at a high level for this offense, it truly makes it dynamic with what he brings to the table. And that doesn't mean that Will Dissly doesn't have a role for this offense. I believe that he does, and I think it'll be great to have two really good tight ends. You add Jacob Hollister to that, three great tight ends that you feel really good about. Philip Dorsett, I believe will be a very explosive, productive player in this offense. I think you're going to see more of his first round talent shine through than it ever has before in his NFL career, because I do believe his skill set perfectly matches and marries with this offense and Russell Wilson's throwing style. So those two guys I feel very excited about in terms of how they're going to mesh and gel together. But I'll tell you right now, if Greg Olsen is receiver three in this conversation during the season, that means the Seahawks offense is one of the best in the NFL.
If Greg Olsen is receiver number three, I'm perfectly fine with that. I would just like, I want to add kind of a fun out of the box question here. If you're a receiver who can get open during the scramble drill, like when Russell's going back and forth, looking, running around, evading receivers, defenders. If you're one of those guys, that will get you a spot on this team. You will be productive. We all agree on that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. There's a guy out there who's currently a free agent that broke his leg at the beginning of last season, who was very, very good at that for a long time for the Seattle Seahawks. Should we consider giving old Jermaine Kearse a look?
No.
I like Jermaine Kearse. I don't think you need Jermaine Kearse right now.
No, I the reason why I'm laughing is not because I don't like Jermaine Kearse. He was a great player for the Seahawks. He was reliable, and honestly, I think that he's a better receiver than people gave him credit for, with some big time catches. But at this point, Jermaine Kearse is done playing football. He is retired. He's moving on and having a great life with his family right now, his young family. But the one guy, Tom, that is out there that is still not a part of this team that I think will be an addition to this team and make this receiving core even more loaded is Josh Gordon. I do believe that once he is off of his suspension, mm-hmm, and that is lifted, I do believe the Seahawks will add him to this group, which will make it very dynamic between the two tight ends, the three tight ends I mentioned, Philip Dorsett, and then Josh Gordon, along with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. I mean, that's a really, really fun and dynamic group. It's all going to be predicated off of this offensive line and how well they can protect.
You guys really don't think if Pete and John gave old Jermaine a call, be like, look, we need you to catch like 19 balls for us. Can you do it?
I mean, yeah, he could do it, but you don't need him to come in and do it. You don't need Jermaine Kearse right now. No offense to Jermaine Kearse, someone who is very well liked in the locker room by coaches, but it's just not a need for your team right now.
I think it is.
Where is this coming from, Tom? Where is this Jermaine Kearse?
You are a bigger fan of Jermaine Kearse right now than you are of Jared Goff, and I didn't think you could be a fan of anything more than you love Jared Goff, except for maybe fish.
Who said anything about Jared Goff? By the way, speaking of fish, Trey Anastasio on the Tonight Show tonight. Everybody should check that out. But I think Jermaine Kearse was a special receiver in this offense and had a good chemistry with Russell. And you need that type of guy. If you're going to single out one guy to be your third wide receiver, like not counting tight ends, that's the type of guy you're looking for. David Moore doesn't have what Jermaine Kearse has. He doesn't have that ability to get open in the scramble drill and just and have Russell find him. He doesn't have it. That's what you need. I'm going to talk to Mike Blowers next, 710 ESPN Seattle.